My next guest mixes art with artfulness, I think you could say, whimsy with vitriol, ridicule with insight, and he does it every day, and he's done this for more than 40 years. Ostensibly, he's here now to flog a book called Musings from the Inner Duck, published by Penguin. So it's best not to get those two species mixed up when you try and buy it. Michael Lunig, welcome to RN Afternoons.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Yeah.
Michael, the last time we spoke was actually a long time ago. I was actually fronting another show on RN called Bush Telegraph, and you and I were talking about your decision to leave Melbourne a long time ago and move into regional Victoria.
Yeah.
These days you tend to split yourself between the both, but the spiritual home's still out in the bush?
I think so, Michael. Yeah, it is. I know that when I return there, as I do frequently, and suddenly I'm part of the landscape, I guess, and comfortable and kind of happy and doing things and occupied, moving about, yeah.
Well, as someone who works in a profession which has, as part of its responsibility, to retain a sense of being outside so you can look in and observe and reflect, do you find that you do different work in the country when you're living there than you do when you work in the city?
It's easier to feel you're not part of the great urban kind of intensity, obviously, and that's a helpful position. One is freer. You don't feel the pressure of opinion, and it's just sort of by osmosis you pick up in the city, that sense of we are a conforming crowd, even though obviously we're not entirely, but there's a lot of that conformity. You don't feel it as much in the bush. The birds are more of an influence, quite literally, the birds. I can look out my studio window and there are the kangaroos just there, and it always used to amuse me to think, oh, here I am with the kangaroos, and tomorrow this cartoon I'm drawing will be being read by perhaps a fella on a tram in a busy city street, and that is just an amusing and happy thought. And there's some health in that, I think. The free spirit is working rather than the oppressed spirit, I think, a bit more in the country.
That's very interesting. So does that mean that as you draw inspiration for that day's cartoon, even the way you spoke about it then, there was a sense of whimsy. Would that find its way into a cartoon more readily from a vista that is more rural?
Yes. Yes, it does. More poetic, more lyrical, not of this world entirely, which is a good position. And really, the political world seems a bit puny compared to the enormity of the bush and its wildness and its trees crashing down and the snakes and et cetera, you know, the spiders. Suddenly, the Prime Minister doesn't seem quite so menacing or interesting. Just more a vulnerable, stumbling soul. And so look, the bush does give you a great sort of sense of life and perspective. And as an old Indigenous friend, now departed, said, in the bush, in the growing up for an Indigenous man, each day faces you like a murderer, meaning, as in an enlivening sense, you have to know it, you have to be on your guard, on your toes. But it's beautiful, but it's not, you don't take it for granted.
That raises so many points because I think as we all get older, we push back at tangible forces, and in so doing, that enriches our lives. And if we don't push back, then maybe sometimes we lose that sense of life.
Yes, a tangible force meaning like natural forces or
the pressure of family, obligation,
yes.
Trying to find out what it is you do that places you in the world, all those things.
Yes, I think. Well, what's different pressures in the city to in the country? I mean, just to push against the tide of humanity walking down the street, often unfriendly, not aggressively unfriendly, but just they can't communicate. They look down, they look away. One is aware of a certain type of isolation.
That comes out in your cartoons too, because when you draw the mass. If memory serves me correctly, often that mass is shrouded in twilight.
Okay, yeah, a twilight world.
Yes.
Well, it is.
Brought on by clouded thinking, perhaps, or something else. I don't know, the twilight brought on by the noise and the dust that they conjure up as they walk together
as
a horde. I don't know.
I would see that, yes. Now that you say it, I can agree to that. But also the twilight is a transitional space, and I think the artist, the poet, the musician, the spiritual world is a transitional space between, you know, the material world and the spirit, the world of spirit and the sense of life itself, the existential mystery, etc. This is a great place to work in that transition and to be able to move freely between both. And because one has a spiritual or poetic dimension does not mean you're not very capable and well-versed in the real, the so-called real world. And you know, what is the real world? old philosophical questions, but you know, enlivening questions, always, I think. And I am glad I can be engaged in these things. That's what I do.
Do you see yourself as an artist who happens to create cartoons, or a cartoonist who happens to paint and write poetry and converse with the world?
Well, there has been a change. I think initially I didn't grow up in an art background. We didn't have art back then. And I'm talking about the 1950s when my sort of conscious childhood was flourishing.
What do you mean you didn't have art back then?
Well, there were no arts festivals, no such thing. It didn't happen. There's a great talk of art, and a lot of artists now, where I grew up, which was called a working class area, we didn't know much about art, or there weren't pictures on the wall. No one talked about it. So this is perfect setting for an artist to grow up without this overwhelming consciousness of the excellence of art. I mean, because art is far more primal than that. It's more from deeper within, not from a known academic world.
Well, the best affecting art can be like that. I mean, there's art that also skates along, you'd have to agree, I'm sure, on the trends of what's happening in the zeitgeist, whatever, you know, pretentiousness or pretentiousness is going on at the moment.
Yes, it's very fashion affected, it's media affected, it's of this world. I mean, it's almost compulsory to be of this world in some streams of art. And I rather like the idea that art is more eternal and kind of deliberately not of this world. Not in the escapist sense, but that there's something more profound and something beyond, something invisible perhaps, which is worth exploring and being engaged in. So
was I wrong to separate cartooning from art? Well, is your art the cartooning?
I'll explain what I mean. So I go into newspapers, which was kind of more like vaudeville, actually. It's, you know, getting a paper out and...
It's a show every day, isn't
it? It's a show every day. Quite impressive, as it used to be. Astonishing drama. And then I wanted to make cartoons and sort of make jokes and observations in this kind of naive way that I, as a young man, thinks he can really do this, but... He can't. He's floundering along.
Is this young man you?
Well, yes, that's me. And so he ends up in court a couple of times and trouble with editors, etc., etc. And then I was always struggling to... I wasn't quite at home in the journalistic world. As much as I admired, had some wonderful journalist friends, really impressive, a great influence on me, but I didn't feel like I was one of them. So gradually it dawned on me, perhaps too late in life, that I was working in media with an artist's sensibility. But I hadn't been taught what an artist's sensibility was, because, as I say, I didn't go to art school, I didn't learn to draw. I had to find it for myself, and that was liberation, I think, to know I didn't have to be a journalist, I didn't have to be on the money or nail it or all those kind of things that media people like to do and is very worthy and interesting. I could wander about in my psyche and be more like, say, a poet or something. And I know that will sound pretentious to a lot of people, but I hold that word in an ordinary, serviceable way. You know, a poet is a value, and the poetic part of all of us is of real value in our daily lives. And we might realize it, but we are poetic somewhere. People do cry when they hear a song, etc. There's a part is awakened. So I realized that that's the realm in which I was working. Human nature rather than human politics. You know, the psyche.
So you're almost like an ambassador for the heart.
Well, I don't mind that. I think that you're right in a sense to speak for the heart, which is so often repressed or alone or kind of uncertain. You're trying to explore that and hold it up and say, look, this is you. You have a heart. Hear it. Look after it. You have an intellect, which is a wonderful, marvelous thing, but you also have a part of you which is the heart of your mind, and that is so I put value on that. And I like your words there, ambassador for the heart.
Well, Michael, in that realm, as we're discussing that, sometimes being the ambassador for the heart has also, as you wander about, using your words, to reflect on the life that you lead and the life that Australians lead. You also verge into political territory with your cartoons in your wandering with the heart.
Mm.
And only recently you came under fire, not for the first time for any cartoon you've put out on paper, but in this case a cartoon that seemed to purport your support for the anti-vaccination lobby, where you were saying, I'm a mother, and the cartoon shows syringes being sort of thrown like darts at a mother fleeing with her baby in a pram. And I think the overriding sentiment there was, you can dazzle me with your scientific intellect, but I have a heart and I feel like I can protect my child. Do you regret making that kind of linkage?
Not at all. No, I that's my job. And to...
Tell me what you mean by that. What's your job?
Well, to uphold the unpopular position, the improbable position, the voice of not just the heart, but of what is improbable, the under-resourced, the minority. That is the traditional role of a cartoonist, not to support the government or the conventional wisdom.
Because you actually argue on your website, if you do, you're a propagandist, or you may be.
Yes, I think, I mean, the great dictators of the world have used cartoonists to advantage in their, you know, their enterprise. But I'm attracted to the one who stands alone, no matter how improbable their position. And I think somewhere at the heart of our civilization, say Western civilization, speaking broadly, there's this idea that the individual and the inspired, heartfelt position has value. And the minute science becomes all-powerful, without any doubt, that I find that disturbing. Because from my understanding, parents who have had grave doubts about immunisation, based on another aspect of science, the science on immunisation may be incomplete. I just want to listen. I think to exile them, to cut them out, to punish them is kind of a dangerous drift in what we hold dear.
Well, it probably also, in a pragmatic sense, will rarely change an anti-vaccination parent's mind to have them clamped down upon by government policy. It may affect their financial outcome, but whether it changes their mind is another thing.
It can sometimes strengthen their position.
Maybe
I understand.
So.
And it bothers me to see the mob being so oppressive to such people who are really anguishing and feeling it deeply. They're often very intelligent people. It's the middle class, the educated middle class, who seem to not be vaccinating. I mean, that's no case against vaccination.
Well, that's hardly a lone person, though, is it? But you've characterised it as a lone person.
Well, they are generally alone. They don't have much power. They only have the power of their conscience and to resist, the power of resistance. And the human history is full of lone individuals standing with their conscience and their conviction. And they're not trying to harm anyone else in their motivation.
Well, one may argue, Michael, that not vaccinating your child may indeed harm that child and the wider populace because of infection and transmission.
I had this with conscription when I was conscripted for the Vietnam War. I was a conscientious objector. I was told I was bludging off the sacrifice of others, etc., etc. I was harmful to society, in other words.
And that was your choice?
That was my choice. I'm not going to do this because I thought I understood what was happening in Vietnam. I was opposed to it, and it turned out to be, you know, a disaster for many.
Well, back to this principle, though, of not trusting the mob and letting the person stand on their own principles, which you're upholding in these vaccination-themed cartoons.
Yeah.
I noticed that, I mean, obviously there's been a lot of comment thrown back at you over this. And again, I take it as a cartoonist, you'd welcome that, wouldn't you? As long as it's not personal.
It does get... There were death threats and stuff. There were death threats. And this is, I recognise, this is kind of unhinged, it's unbalanced, it's a bit profoundly unpleasant.
Yes.
Not just against me, but against family, etc.
Well, that's not right, is it?
Well, no, but we live in a world that's not right. And the thing is that here is this concern for health. So you get one little jab or two little jabs or increasing number of jabs that seem to go on infinitely as they invent them. You have this idea that you're not caring for health. Meanwhile, we have a culture, we have a media, we have cities, we have civil engineering, which is profoundly unhealthy. We have people cracking up. We have a society which could be argued is going quite mad. The mental health is appalling. The statistics are horrible. And if we're really serious about health, it's so easy to be serious about a jab and it's all done and taken care of.
Well, can I point out just one thing, because I want to move on, but I just want to say that in relation to some of the opposition, I was reading some of the comments online to that cartoon you put out in April.
Yeah.
And one of them, I thought, came straight to the point in terms of their opposition. What that was, I do have a heart, and because I have a heart, I'm vaccinating my child.
Totally agree with them. Totally agree. I'm not standing just up for them. I'm standing for anybody who wants to be a parent in the way that I think there's something about the parental responsibility which I support, you know, except in obviously appalling abusive cases. But parents, by and large, are very conscientious. They think deeply. A lot is at stake. Mm. And if they choose that, that's their affair, and I support that. But I also equally feel great sympathy, and I want to listen to. I don't want to be too quick to see them marginalised, punished, exiled from the mainstream. I've had the belligerence of the pro-vaccination is quite surprising as a personality disorder, almost. So belligerent, so angry that one isn't marching with the regiment.
Well, I'm telling you now that this conversation is going to enact a whole other raft of comments, and that's to be expected and perhaps encouraged as long as people listening exercise some tactfulness in the way they deal with that.
And if it brings people to an acute sensibility about this question, great. On either side, it's great. It's always healthy.
My guest is cartoonist Michael Lunig, who's got a new book out called Musings from the Inner Duck. Michael, as we speak to you today, in a couple of days' time, you turn 70.
I do.
How are you feeling about that?
Oh, good. Yeah. It's I've never had one of that feeling of a significant birthday, like 30 or 40 or 50. I've never had that, but now I have. It's the biblical 70, the lifetime. And it feels like I've had a lifetime. And I'm, you know, if I fall off the twig afterwards, well, so be it.
All right, so you're happy you've reached 70, you can go peacefully into this good night, can you?
Well, you can go playfully into this good night, not peacefully, and it doesn't matter so much anymore. I mean, remember this feeling when my first child was born. I thought, oh, this great relief. I'm no longer the one at the forefront of the evolution. Now my son takes over, you see. And there was some funny existential feeling of being freed from some thing I was carrying, like it's just about me, and now suddenly it's my son, he's going to help, and then now grandchildren. So
you can see the succession planning already stretching ahead.
Exactly, yeah, the divine plan, but nature's plan maybe, but I feel I was 70, I don't have to do this anymore. I want to be a slightly funny, difficult old fellow, not unpleasantly difficult, but not to fall in line, you know, to be free. How I love to hear people of advanced years and maturity just saying what they think, and I think 70 grants you a permission. So, look, say what you think. You might end up in jail these days, but I don't know. It seems it could be a creatively liberated time, and health is okay.
Yeah. I think you're ticking all the boxes then. I think you've got your wish list happening quite well. You're still stirring the possum. Still creating cartoons and illustrations and thoughts and poetry that provoke all of us to think differently about the world we've just woken up to. And I think you're doing your job.
Well, thank you. But it's taken me a long time to grow up, really. Maturity is quite an enterprise. You know, in fact, we look down on it, don't we? We live in a world where people are proud to say, oh, I'm just a big kid. I don't want to grow up. You know, I do want to grow up.
Do you? One day it'll happen.
To grow up is to become free, to become truly playful, truly creative, and stop repeating all the cliches about what life is and this, you must do this and you must do that, and, you know, this nationalism and this nonsense. I don't feel like I'm an Australian, perhaps. I just feel like a human being, a creature. These external surface things don't matter. My family and that, you know, love them all, but one is free, one is a spirit. And he said...
Well, happy birthday. Michael, can I ask you to help us celebrate by putting something on paper as a way of sort of marking your time on the planet today, because and that's what you do every day, isn't it? You mark your place on the planet by putting something out that other people reflect on.
You make a little mark. We all do it. You do it with words. I think we Mars. Well, why else would you live except to touch each other, you know?
Well, can you touch a piece of paper with a pen? And we might put this up online as an example of how Michael Lunig is thinking right now.
Well, very minimally, I can tell you. I could just repeat one of my old songs, if you like. But
go on.
No, it's what's just, that? I always, the song, meaning the little drawing will do. I mean, it's like a song, it's like a poem. It's a nonsense. It's a sort of, you draw what you can draw. And this morning, I can't draw too much. But I love to draw this little character that I've drawn all my life. And for some reason, I feel in the company of another type of human who's kind of a lovelier human perhaps than I am. And
Michael's drawing as he gives us a commentary, which is very radio of him.
Yeah, I'm drawing away. I'm just doing this little thing with a bird. Or is it a man? Is it a woman? Is it a child? I don't know.
Do you sometimes wait to see what you've drawn before ruling what it is you're going to place as a caption?
Indeed. In fact, it's an escape into this, as I say, an inventive playfulness with the pen, and there are many bits of paper lying about. But it's a happy bird day, you see.
It's a happy bird day. Yeah. Of course it is.
Very corny, eh?
I'm going to finish, if you don't mind, by reading out. No, in fact, I'll get you to read out the last page of your most recent book, which you're here to talk about, Musings from the Inner Dark.
Yes.
It's not bad to read out the last page because every page is a story unto itself, so it's not like you're ruining the whole book. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's lovely.
Yeah good. All right. So if you could read that out for us, and we'll say goodbye. I've got the book there for you.
Yeah, so here's Mr. Curly hanging in a tree with an angel and a possum. The days are getting shorter. The nights are getting longer. A part of me is weaker. Another part is stronger. Another summer's over, and we are going under. We are going home now to ponder and to wonder.
Michael Lunig, thank you so much for coming on RN Afternoons.
Thank you, Michael.